This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 415 for March 30th of 2018. Auto-extreming all over the place. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Well, Mr. Vasilash, here we are yet again.
Yes, we are. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, as a matter of fact.
It's opening day in Detroit, and it's not snowing. But no, it is raining.
It is raining, and it's cold, so there ain't no baseball today. But, hey, we got to let everybody know we've got the auto extremist himself, Dr. Peter DiLorenzo.
Back from the dead.
Back from the dead. Great having you here.
Glad to be here.
And, you know, we got a lot to talk about on this show. We'll see if we get through it all. We probably won't just because there's so much. But, Peter, you wrote a column this week looking at the Detroit Auto Show, and oh, my God, OMG. It looks like it's falling apart by the day here.
Well, yeah, it's bad. BMW just announced they're not going to come back.
And Mercedes did.
Mercedes already did. Who else? Volvo. I mean, a bunch of automakers. But it's really sad. And then you go to New York and you realize just how bad the Detroit show is.
Because everybody's there.
Yeah. And there were more announcements at the New York show than there were at Detroit the last few years put together.
So why New York and not Detroit? Why a place where we associate with yellow Crown Victorias and not private car ownership? And here we are in the Motor City, and yet, you know, this thing could be on life support.
Well, you know, I've been campaigning for years to move the date.
And get it out of the winter.
Get it out of January. And, you know, when L.A. Crept up on Detroit, then they backed it off. Things were fine until CES came along.
Yeah.
Once CES came along, Detroit was on borrowed time. And there was no movement to move the show dates. They were just, like, locked into this January.
Not only that, they loved it. When you talk to the Detroit Auto Dealers Association about this very thing, and I have, it was like, no, January is a good time because you have everybody captive. They can't go anyplace. It's freezing cold
outside.
Well,
you know, it's winter in Detroit. No one is going to be, you know, going to car dealerships on a regular basis for, you know, like, hey, honey, let's go out and take a drive and go to the car dealership. But if they see eye candy at a show, they're maybe
when the show started as a little regional show for the dealers for the worst sales months of the year. And it was fine like that for a while. Then it became the North American International Auto Show, and it went along fine for a while. And then, you know, there are too many shows, number one, too many more important shows, it seems. The weather didn't help. I mean, let's face it. I mean, I heard everyone every year, boy, this weather really sucks. And I just think they needed to move it a long time ago. So now CES has stolen their thunder. Now the manufacturers would rather be in L.A. or New York. Why New York? Good point. I mean, besides the fact it's the media center of the U.S., and they get all kinds of coverage.
People like New York. It's a fun town, actually.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and then all the luxury manufacturers are at the New York show, whereas they're just skipping Detroit because they don't do enough business. So now, all of a sudden, you know, the Detroit Dealers Association, which runs the show, or whoever you know them, John, I don't know them all, but they say they're going to move it to October. Okay, October's a great month around here. But they're saying they're still going to have the show in Cobo next January.
Two shows in one year.
Yeah, which I think
that's not going to work.
That's a mistake.
I totally agree.
So why? Okay, why in your estimation have these German companies pulled out?
I don't really think. Well, now, John, you've talked about this before, but auto show itself is an endangered species.
Right.
Because these manufacturers have found that it's much more cost effective to fly journalists to a standalone event, but have them in captivity. They can let them drive the car and they don't have any competing messages. And so they said, well, you know, that's probably worth our while more than putting on an auto show display for whatever, $20 million.
Well, you know, I've been trading some commentary back and forth on Facebook or something like that with Rachel Conrad, who had been at Nissan PR. She's not in the auto business now, I don't believe.
No, she works for that company that makes those fake hamburgers that bleed. Literally. It's a veggie burger company that is in Silicon Valley that
really?
I wish I could remember the name of it.
Okay. You'll think of it before the end of the show, probably.
Possibly. She also worked at Tesla.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But anyway, her point was if you want to be a lavishly spending car company, you can spend $1 million and bring in 400 journalists from all over the world and have this big blowout presentation. And it's cheaper than having a half-hour press conference at the Detroit Auto Show that you're going to spend at least $3 million on. That's just to get the spot and everything like that. You're not even looking at the cost of your display and everything. So there's one reason. It's just a pure dollars and cents thing. Why should I spend millions of dollars to get 30 minutes of these journalists who now run off to see what my competition's doing versus spending a lot less money and having them for even a couple of days, possibly, at a nice resort.
So why do car companies care about journalists at auto shows? I mean, basically, journalists, you know, they don't buy cars, and if they do buy cars, they only buy station wagons with diesels and manual transmissions, and there aren't very many of those, right?
Right.
So why isn't it, I mean, so the Detroit show is put on by the Detroit Auto Dealers Association. What do these people want to do? Sell cars.
Yeah. Well,
why do they care about journalists?
Yeah, the Detroit show's is already a second-tier show right now. Yeah. It's going back to being a regional show.
Right.
Because they're not moving fast enough. I mean, they're going to have two shows in 19, and I think that's a mistake. I think they should get all the people involved and say, look, yeah, we know we blocked out Cobo for that, but we can't. We've got to come to an agreement, move the show. October 19, the new show, reinvent, great time of year. But
that ain't going to do it. But to get to your point, Gary, well, why do they want the media? Because the media is going to write all these stories, and it's going to be on radio and TV and online and in print, and that's why you bring the media in. You want all this stuff. But, as you guys know, all the big stories, they've pretty much leaked a month before the show ever starts, so that as of day one, all us in the media can have all these stories all pre-prepared. But then you go to the show, and it's like, there's nothing new. Seen it, got it.
Right. The only thing that was new was the Atlas pickup or the...
No, the Detroit show?
No, New York.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of surprising.
Yeah. Right.
But, I just think that the car companies have to recognize, you know, that they can get coverage from journalists at other times of the year, not associated with shows. I mean, we've done after hours on drive programs, right?
And
all the journalists that were on those drive programs, I mean, so they got coverage from Car and Driver and Motor Trend and Road and Track and, you know, the Road Show by CNET and on and on and on. They get it anyway. So, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I think what you got to do is just like horses for courses. Put it to the consumer. Don't put it to the journalist.
Well, the number one show in the U.S. is Chicago.
Right. They get over 1 million attendees.
Yeah, and that...
And they do it in February,
and
right?
And considered a retail show.
Right, right.
A shopping show.
But the other thing, too, is, you know, let's get real. The Chicago show is cars on a carpet. It's not the lavish displays that take weeks to build like the Detroit show is. And that's probably going to go away in Detroit because that's hugely expensive.
Well, if they decide to have the show in next January and then in October, January, it's going to be like a few Klieg lights and a few cars. Yeah. It's going to be like Klieg a car lot.
Card tables.
I can't remember who told
folding
me.
Chairs.
But they said what the plans are for the Detroit show right now are to make it like Geneva, where nothing in your display can be over 3 feet tall, and everybody gets a sign that hangs over their display that is exactly the same size, exactly the same shape and color. So, again, all with an eye of taking costs way down. But I don't think that's going to do it. I don't think that's enough to save the show.
Well, as you recall, we had Trevor Paul from Planet M on the show a month or two ago. And, you know, they're involved because they put on the automobility portion of the auto show. And my understanding is that they're going to really amp up their activities to make this more of a draw and more of an event rather than simply an auto show. And I can see you getting ready to
Well, I just think that's barking someone. Up the wrong tree. I mean, CES is already there. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to out CES.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what, I don't care what they call it. It's just not going to.
And, you know, look, CES has always been there.
Yeah.
They haven't changed the dates. That what's changed is that, you know, I went to CES 20 years ago, and it was companies with woofers that you could put in your car and fancy speaker grills. It was almost just this side of SEMA, really. It wasn't much better than SEMA from an automotive standpoint. Now, with autonomy, electrification, all this move to mobility services, and the most important thing of all, car companies that want to be perceived as tech companies so that Wall Street gives their stock a better valuation, they're all going to CES because that's how you get seen as a tech company, not going to the Detroit show.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so I found the name of Rachel Conrad's company that she works for, and okay. And I'm just wondering.
Burgers that bleed?
No. She's probably going to smack me next time she sees me from me saying that. But so the name of her company, and I'm wondering if this is the sense that you have for Detroit going forward. The name of the company she works for is Impossible Foods.
Wow. I don't know.
All right, so New York is going on. It starts for the public tomorrow. Today was the last media day. You mentioned the Volkswagen Tanok, which is
Tanok or is it Tanowak?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's a dumb name.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, Volkswagen goes out of their way to torture all of us with their stupid names.
Yeah. It looks more sayable than Touareg, though. So, you know, we can look at it from that point of view.
Yeah. You see, Al-Qaeda has now aligned itself with the Touareg tribe in North Africa.
It's funny. All the media reports about that pickup did not mention the Honda pickup. And to me, that's its principal competitor.
Right. Because this is going to be a unit body.
Yeah, yeah, they all mentioned all these other pickups. I said, well, I don't know. What about the Honda?
The Honda's a flop.
That's too bad. I really like
it. I like the truck a lot.
I like the truck a lot, too.
I could get one. You don't have your sales numbers there, do you? Or do you?
Yeah. Like, I think the reason is that compared to the Honda Ridgeline, they're basically making it look more, I mean, even though the new Ridgeline looks more like a pickup truck than the first generation Ridgeline looked like a pickup truck. And in fact, we did it after hours on that drive.
Yes, we did.
So, and they didn't have to come to Detroit. So I think that's why they made the comparisons. And so I think that, you know, basing this on the Atlas, which, you know, is the big brawny non-Touareg Volkswagen people mover. They want to, you know, intimate that that's where they're going with it. And goodness knows that that category is certainly one that...
I actually like the other Atlas they showed, the
short wheelbase.
The two-row.
Cross-sport concept.
Yeah, I thought that was really good.
I don't know. I don't like the styling of the vehicle. I don't like, they've got this funny crease line that runs just above the wheel wells down the side of, over the wheel. There's something about, other people like it. So, you know, styling.
I got to tell you, compared to the Lexus
UX,
which is absolutely horrifying in person. I mean, it is unbelievably bad. They tried to hang that spindle grill and make the front end look much bigger than the vehicle is, and it's just a complete flop. I mean, the only car that the spindle grill works on, let's face it, is the LC500. I mean, it doesn't work on the big sedan, but that UX is just an abomination. I was shocked how bad it is.
Busy design.
Really busy.
All right, so you wanted the Ridgeline salesman.
Yeah,
so for all of last year, they sold 34,749.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look towards the tail end of the year, they really started to drop off. Sales did.
Oddly enough, though, that was a 46.8% increase over the previous year's sales. So.
Yeah, well, because it started late in the year, and so, but I think it's they got everybody who's going to buy one early on, and now sales are really falling off.
But you know what's interesting to me about the Atlas Cross Sport concept was that they presented it as being a high-performance hybrid, yet I'm sure that the production version of the car is going to be...
Let me just tell you, every manufacturer that says, well, we're all going to be hybrid this, hybrid that, it's just like, okay, that's a giant we'll see. Because when they come out, they're not going to be hybrids.
Look, Peter, the market has voted. It doesn't want hybrids.
I know.
You know, we've had hybrids since 1999. There's over 30 models that you can buy. Small ones, big ones, cheap ones, expensive ones, crossovers, passenger cars, even a pickup. And they're 2% of the market.
Another observation from the show was, I think we're hitting peak Porsche.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you say so?
There was...
Too many variations of the same
car. Yeah, I mean, there was... Okay, they had a 911 T there, which is the classic Porsche formula. D-content plus limited production plus piles of cash... then they had a 911 GT3 RS, but it's just like they've done that car 1,000 different times, and it was just like, yeah, okay. Then they had a silver Cayenne, and then they had two white Panamera hybrids, a Sport Turismo and a regular Panamera, and they didn't have anything else on display. And I was just like, I don't know about Porsche. I'm beginning to wonder. I used to think it was bulletproof. As long as they manage their brand strategy, their brand image, it's be okay. But I think they're really running too close to the sun right now.
Interesting you say that because, you know, they keep growing.
Yeah.
How do you keep growing when you're really kind of a niche brand? And what makes part of the appeal and keeps up your residual values is you are niche.
Yeah.
And now they're over what? Over 250,000 vehicles a year. And you might have something there. I felt, going back a year ago, that BMW had jumped the shark.
Oh, BMW definitely did. They have too many models. They're trying to cover every niche, both real and imagined, at this point.
The other thing, too, BMW is stuck with an instrument panel layout that is the same in every vehicle and has been the same for many, many years now. At least when you get into Mercedes, even if you don't like the design of the IP and everything, it's different, it's modern, it's more refreshed and the like. But
I can't get over the money they spent on the inside of that G-Class. Mm-hmm. Man, that is really sweet inside. Mm-hmm. It's cool.
Introduced in Detroit, too.
Yeah.
So what did you think? I'm going to ask you and then I'll sit back and listen. Cadillac XT4.
I just thought it was a major disappointment. I just think, it's 4 years late? Mm-hmm. And I thought the interior was, I don't know what it is about GM interiors of late. Some of them are pretty good, but a lot of them are just not quite right. And I don't know if that's a financial decision or what. But, well, classic example, the Chevy Bolt, which I think is great. If they had spent $100 per car more on the interior, they'd really have something with that vehicle.
Right.
But they didn't. They cheaped out on it. And so, I don't know, the XT4 looks sawed off and not that appealing to me. It just really didn't appeal to me at all.
Yeah. So the thing I didn't understand, and maybe one of you can clarify this for me, but... Cadillac debuted its new global Y trim strategy. What the hell is that?
I have no idea.
I do. It's they're now only going to offer three levels of trim going forward. So they have one that's called luxury. That's the base car. Then they have one, I think it's called premium luxury. I'm looking at Sean off here. He's nodding at me.
Just distinctive premium.
And then they have one called sport. So three trim levels, and you can do some options and difference on that, but that's what they're...
What does that have to do with a Y? I thought that was they were referencing the Buick Y-Job or something. I mean, it's just.
I don't know. I just thought the XT4 was really instantly forgettable.
Now, one car that.
Although compared to the UX, it's like a Maybach. I don't know. It's just.
Hey, wait a minute. Before we hold your thought there, Gary, because we got to take a quick commercial break and give a shout out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
A lot of cars to sell.
Okay, we're back. Okay, I told you to hold a thought there, Gary, but we just got a question from Mac Murphy. What do you guys think of the Lincoln Aviator?
Which is what I was just going about to talk about. Okay. So it's a perfect. I mean, I am very impressed with that vehicle. So it's a three row. It's
fits between the Navigator and the Nautilus, right?
Correct. And so it's not a midsize. It's not a full size. It's a sort of a different sort of size. I mean, the most magnificent part about that is the way that the roof line slopes back.
Slightly, okay. Yeah.
Here we got a picture of it.
And so I was...
looks like a baby Navigator.
It doesn't. It honestly
really?
Doesn't.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at it up close, you see a lot of differences.
It's much more sleek than
more yeah, sleek. The grill looks the same, but you get close to it and you see that they've basically reversed the whole thing. You know, what was interesting is the fact that they were able. They said that you can get a 90th percentile adult, so the 6 foot person to sit in the third row without having
his
head attenuated. And
here's what impressed me about it. That's based off the Explorer. It doesn't look like an Explorer at all.
It's a new platform.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is the first deployment of this platform.
And I will say this.
It's a rear drive platform, all-wheel drive, and they're going to offer a hybrid.
Yeah.
Well, you have to.
I will say this about Lincoln. Their interiors are gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
They're doing a great job in their interiors.
So to that point, we saw the XT4. Now we see the Lincoln Aviator. So what do you think about the crosstown rivalry? Who's going to do a better job with this?
I think Lincoln's going to kick Cadillac's butt. Why? Because Lincoln finally realized that sticking to their ridiculous nomenclature was a dead end. And they're starting to attach names to their vehicles. And, you know, to me, it's a simple solution. Now, Johann's decided to remake Cadillac in Audi's image, and I don't think it's been successful. I mean, yeah, there's some good engineering going on and that sort of thing. But this naming regimen for Cadillac is just, you know. Then they said they're going to bring out the Escala.
Yeah.
And I said, what are they going to call it? The CT8 or some deadbeat name. I mean, I think, you know, they should. They've got such great names in their history, or come up with new ones. They've got three new ones: CL, El Mirage, Scala.
I'm with you on that, because if you want to break out of the clutter, you're not going to do it with numbers and letters. You just blend in right with everybody else, and everyone's got an X in their jumble of letters names now. So, yeah, I'm with you totally.
But what do you think about, like,
the
styling and execution, you know, that Lincoln is taking more of a reserved, sophisticated approach,
I think,
and Cadillac is still, I mean, they won't call it art and science anymore, but isn't that what it basically still is?
Cadillac wants to be the American alternative to the Germans, just like Lexus and Genesis and the rest of them are trying to be. Lincoln's not playing that game. It's saying quiet luxury. And they're trying to do all this stuff that's very service-oriented. We'll come pick up the car. We'll help you come through security at the airport. We'll do all these other kind of crazy things that nobody else is doing. I think it's going to pay off for them. Their numbers are still small, and it's going to take a while for this to catch on. But I like Lincoln's strategy. I think Cadillac's cars are actually better engineered.
Yeah.
But Lincoln's strategy, I think, is a smarter one.
Well, the strategy of going after quiet and serenity, you know, was like Big Lebowski. You know, say what you will, but it's an ethos, you know. But I like it. You know, when's the last time a manufacturer used glide in their introductory marks? They did with the Aviator. I mean, they're just going for, you know, we want you to, you know.
Smooth. Comfortable, just, you know, and when you think about it, or when I think about it, it almost strikes me that Cadillac isn't going after Audi, despite the fact that Johann used to work there. You might make the argument that Cadillac is going after Lexus, right? Which has the same alphanumeric nomenclature, and if you look at the lines of those cars, they're both going at it. And at this point, Lexus is just more exaggerated.
Well, Cadillac is still doing the Nürburgring thing, and they're still trying to...
Yeah, but everybody's doing that,
well,
right?
Well, not everyone. I mean, Lincoln...
Kia put the Stinger on the Nürburgring, and,
whatever.
You know...
Jeez. But,
look,
yeah, I think...
Everyone's doing the performance thing. Why? Because you put on some wheels and the Brembo calipers and a few other things, and now you can charge 10 to 15% more for it, so your margins are better. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, I mean, and look at what the most successful Cadillac is. Escalade. Now, the XT5 is doing well. Why? Because if you have an SUV, someone's going to buy it. You know, we're in that mode. But the Escalade is the one.
Mm-hmm.
Have you priced one of those lately?
Woo!
I went on their site the other day and just priced a platinum.
100 grand, right? Or knocking on the
platinum,
door.
Not an ESV, but just a platinum short wheelbase. The way I want it was, it was almost 100 grand. It was just like, wow.
No, the other thing, too, is is it the XTS, their old carryover sedan
that we liked.
Is their best-selling car, passenger car.
It looks great. They refreshed it.
It looks terrific.
GM Design did a great job on it.
And they don't tell anybody about it.
Okay, no.
But couldn't you make the argument that is their Continental?
Yeah. Right? Absolutely.
And they don't tell anybody about it because it was with the same platform the Impala was on.
Right.
And
if they called the XTS the Fleetwood,
I bet
their sales would go up in double digits percentage.
Yeah, but they don't want to talk about that because you couldn't take that on the Nürburgring.
So right now I think Lincoln's going to, is on an upward trajectory. Because, you know, they made the decision from the get-go, we aren't going to outdo anyone on the Nürburgring.
Right.
We're going for classic American luxury.
Right. But here's the other thing. We can't judge Lincoln's success solely on sales because they're going to get rid of their passenger car. They're going to get rid of the MKZ. And what do they still have left?
Continental.
Well, the Continental they got to keep. It just came out.
Well, they're going to
pay for the tooling.
They're going to do a bigger Continental. Probably call it Continental Mark 10.
They should call it the Town Car if they're going to do that.
Yeah. Well, there's still Mark something if it's a Continental.
But all I'm saying is that in the next couple of years, Lincoln sales are likely to go down as they jettison their cars.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying, you know, I don't want somebody to call back into the show 2 years from now and say, you said they were going to do better, and they're not. And so it's not going to be purely sales that dictate it.
Well, basically, I mean, literally all they have right now is the Continental and the MKZ.
Yeah.
I mean, because the MKS went away, right?
And just went away, right.
So that's gone.
Now
so
they've got, you know, the Navigator and the Aviator and the Nautilus and, you know, they're all
in the MKC. Which has not been given a name yet.
Yeah.
Nautilus is MKX.
Yeah.
So
I assume the C will get something.
Because it's a refresh.
Yeah.
They'll put that same new nose on the C and they'll give it a name.
It's interesting that they're actually sticking with that for more than one generation. Remember, they kept, you know, like, this is the new face of Lincoln, and you had the waterfall grill, and this is the new face of Lincoln, and it was those wings that were going out.
And it was never mind.
Yeah, I mean, it was just...
Well, remember, too, every new designer who gets put in charge of Lincoln, put a different nose on the car.
Wants to put their stamp on it.
They want to put their stamp on it. And the reason I think they're sticking at with it is, number one, it's still the same designer, David Woodhouse, who's running it. And number two, it's working.
Right.
Holy moly. It's unbelievable how that look has worked.
Well, the best, again, the smartest thing they did is let the interior designers do their thing, give them the money to do their thing, and not decontent the, you know, or not discourage them by saying, oh, we can't do that. Yeah. The cost per unit is really too much. No. I mean, when you get these new Lincolns, they look really good inside.
The Navigator and the Continental are top-notch, no question about it. Hey, it's halfway through the hour here, and typically this is the time when we bring in Dr. Data.
Okay, so
got a number?
Oh, of course. All right, so this one is all right. You're not going to be able to see anything, John. So you're not going to be able to read through the image.
Cheat.
No, but this is going to be so easy that if one of you guys don't get it like that, I will be shocked.
I'm
so
a dumbass.
Carmen. No, you're not dumbasses. I'll just be shocked. So, Carmen, bring up the numbers, please. $2.68, $2.28, $1.96 are the numbers.
And those of you want to take a stab at it, Peter?
No.
I'm going to say they're gasoline prices. And the top number is right now. The bottom number is probably about a year ago. And the number under that is probably a couple of years ago.
I thought gas prices, too, but then I thought Gary's up to something. It must be something else.
Well,
it's the price of Wonder Bread.
John, you were nearly right. But
I'm wrong.
But you just messed up on that middle one. So $2.68 is the price this week of a gallon of gas in Detroit area. That would go back to 2017, 2016. So I started looking at those numbers, and this is why I find this to be very interesting, is that, okay, I don't think people are paying a whole lot of attention to what's going on. And so if you look at that, so from $1.96 to $2.28, it was a 16% rise in price. And then from $2.28 to $2.68 is a 17.5% rise in price. So then I thought, okay, what if we just continue on this? So then if the past is prelude, then next year at this time, we're going to be bumping over $3.13 a gallon. But it even gets more interesting because the analyst from GasBuddy who was talking about these numbers said, as March wraps up, gas prices are going out like a small lion, but there may be a larger lion looming in the weeks ahead. So actually, we may be seeing a larger bump, which will make that 17% increase look like we wish we had it.
Well, premium's already gone way up
right
in Detroit, so...
And in California, it's probably closer to $4 a gallon.
Right.
But I don't believe. Why does he think gas prices are going up?
Well, I mean, I mean, at this time of year, gas prices are going up because we have to switch from the winter blend to
the
summer
classic,
blend, right? I mean, so we have that sort of thing going on. But he doesn't indicate why this is going to be happening. But my point is that. Isn't this like a little bit like Chinese water torture that, you know, is this drip, 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 and you don't notice it? And then it's like, holy crap, I got a hole in my head.
Well, yeah, what's the number where it starts affecting
car sales,
trucks and SUV sales?
Right. Well, it will, you know, and, you know, if you boil the frog slowly, which actually those price increases have been, the consumer doesn't notice. If it goes up fast, that's when everybody runs out to buy a Prius. But I don't think that, look at what's going on. The U.S. production of oil is going up really strong. It's only going to get stronger. There's new fracking technology that's right around the corner, if it pans out, where they're using microwaves to get the stuff out. There's this shale oil deposit under like Colorado and a couple of the surrounding states there that if I remember the numbers right, Saudi Arabia has like 280 billion barrels of oil. This deposit is 3 trillion. Hmm. So,
Jeb, move away from here.
Yeah. Right. And so,
loaded up the truck
with the new
Beverly.
Fracking stuff, too, you don't need much water.
But you need a refinery, and there seems to be limited refinery capacity in the United States, and therein lies a big problem.
Well, you know, we export a lot of distilled distillates, refined products. So I'm not too worried.
Actually, BP does. We don't.
Yeah. Okay. But all I'm getting at is, you know, OPEC tried to cut back on production to drive prices up. They've been somewhat successful in it. But the more prices go up, the more affordable it is for marginal frackers to jump in on this. And remember, so far, it's only the United States that's doing any fracking. One of these days, Mexico, Argentina, other countries with the right amount of geological formation are going to go, whoa, what are we sitting on our hands for? We should get involved in this, too.
So you think that gas prices are going to go down?
No, what I'm saying is I think gas prices will bounce in a range from roughly $50 to $80 a barrel from here as far out as we can see. So I don't see it getting very cheap. I don't see it getting really expensive. I see it sort of simmering in around where it's been.
So if it's at about $80 a barrel, that roughly would translate into gasoline that is above $3 a gallon.
Correct. Probably
about
$3.50.
Okay, so at $3.50 a gallon, do people say, you know what, I really don't want to buy that Escalade, or do they?
Well, there is a point, but we don't know what that is. We really don't know what people will think. I mean, for a lot of people, you can afford $100,000 for an Escalade.
If you peel off another 20 a week to fill the tank, big deal.
Yeah.
You know? But
the pickup buyers,
right,
that might be a little different because a lot of those are used for work and, you know, that's a different area.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. Car sales and the mix are very sensitive to gas prices.
So John, you just spent several days at the National Auto Dealers Association speaking of car sales.
Yeah.
So what was your sense there? I mean, was it heady times or were people cautious? What was the nature of
the buzz on the floor? Was really good. And to me, you know, I haven't been to the NADA in years, so it was all eye candy to me. All the displays, all this different equipment that they sell to dealerships. I was stunned at how many zillions of companies were there that all depend on car dealers for their own livelihood. But the big trend, the digitization of the car dealership. You know, all these companies that will handle your inventory, that will provide sales leads, that will do your marketing, that will tie this all in together and sell different kinds of software-based services. Wow. It was stunning how many of these companies are there. And the dealers feel good. And, you know, they just came off a great year. They all have a bunch of money. They're feeling really good. But what was most interesting was asking them, like Rob Kernick, who runs Penske Automotive, or Mark Scarpelli, who's the outgoing chairman and the like, what are you guys going to do about electric cars? And that they are concerned about. Because they see all these electric cars coming, and their whole thing is the customers don't really want these things.
Well, we don't, and there's not an infrastructure to support them either. I mean, there really isn't.
Well, there is in certain areas. So California has got a reasonably good infrastructure, and it's really getting built up fast. But the message from these guys were, look, we'll sell whatever the public wants. You know, if the public wants electrics, we'll sell electrics all day long, but they're not coming in and asking for electrics.
So was there any concern? I mean, you know, you were talking about all the digitization of what's going on, and it sort of sounds to me a little bit like, you know, okay, they're paving the cow pass. I mean, are these guys actually saying, okay, we're going to have to embrace this digitization in a big way, and just as people buy stuff on Amazon, that perhaps that is the way they're going to want to start buying automobiles?
There is that. But first off, you know, the digitization stuff can help dealerships become more efficient. And one of the big topics in the retailer part of the business now is what they're calling margin compression. The NADA put out stats for last year that shows that from a passenger car basis, on average, every dealer lost $400 on every car that they sold. Now, that's for pass cars, right? And that's an average. So if you're selling an LC500, you're probably making some good money on it. But what's happened is that dealers, the vast majority of them, they're family-owned. They're pretty simple, straightforward. Hey, if we got to do better, we'll just sell more cars. That's how we do it. Sell more new, sell more used. But now their margins are shrinking. So they're looking for ways, the smart ones are looking for ways, how do we get more efficient at what we're doing? So in talking to Rob Kernick at Penske Automotive, he said, we actually increased our margins by $86 a year last year, largely through efficiency, not just through markups. And so, yeah, the smart dealerships are investing in ways that will make them more efficient.
What about the, whole growing subscription for cars? You don't buy a car, you...
I didn't talk to them much about that. Number one, it's very new. You know, Cadillac and Porsche have piloted some, but it's only in a couple of cities. Volvo is just now getting going. So I think for these guys, it was a little too new. But what they'll tell you is, hey, if that's the way the customer wants to buy, that's what we're going to do. Now, I'm talking about the forward-thinking ones that are trying to adjust themselves to this new reality. You know, we talked a lot about ride-sharing and all that stuff. Again, the smart ones are very bullish about it because they're saying, look, if you're going to run 20, 30 people, 40 people through an Uber or a Lyft car every day at night, you're going to have to clean that thing. It's going to have to be pristine. You're going to have to do maintenance on it so that it's ready for the next day. And you're going to want to have facilities that can do that in every single community. Hey, we're hand raisers. We'll do that for you. And it's interesting, Waymo is partnering with AutoNation. AutoNation's doing all the servicing of Waymo's autonomous vehicles. So even the high-tech companies in Silicon Valley realize when the rubber hits the road, we need brick and mortar out there.
They don't want to change that rubber. They want to leave
that's
that.
Right.
Well, Peter, what do you think about subscriptions for cars rather than buying cars? Which means you can quickly, you know, unlike leasing, that you're stuck with it.
I think it's fine if you have the cash flow to support it. But, I mean, you know, for Cadillac, it's, what, $1,500 a month? And then for Porsche, it approaches $3,000 a month. I mean, that's a lot. Down includes insurance, and you can switch car to car, but still, I think it favors higher income people. I don't think it's going to be...
It's not a gift to the consumer.
No.
Not at all. Neither was leasing. But look how popular leasing has become. In fact, so popular that a lot of car companies are trying to throttle back because too many people are leasing.
Yeah, because they can't handle the used cars coming off lease. They
don't. Exactly. Hey, we got to take another quick commercial break. We've got a lot more questions, a few phone calls that we're going to get to. But first, a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Gary, you have anything else that you were, that I cut you rudely?
No. We were just talking about the subscription thing. And, you know, I just wonder whether, okay, high-end car companies are doing this now. And I suppose that's to cycle people through their cars to get a taste of what they're like. But I just wonder, imagine if a mainstream brand started doing that to appeal to people, you know, young people who might not be interested in buying a car, giving them the opportunity to live with one or two or three over a short period of time without having to, you know, outright buy it or lease it. Might this not be a way to get them interested enough in cars to actually buy one?
Sure, but I don't see how they can do it for under $500 or $600 a month.
Well, I think what you're going to see is, you know, Volvo's got a $600 a month or a $700 a month. You can get out of that car in a year's time and step into another Volvo. Well, what are you going to do with that car that just came back after only a year? Well, it's pretty obvious, I think. Now that's going to get leased out at $400 a month, all in, insurance, everything like that. Now, how low can you get that when you're including all maintenance, all insurance, everything? I don't know. But they are going, I think this is going to be a logistical challenge for Volvo to be able to pull off. But I think that's the next step, is releasing that thing as a slightly used vehicle, or not resubscribing it. Hey, speaking of car buying experience, we got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that one in from Dale Leonard.
Greetings, gentlemen. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. And first off, Peter, it's wonderful to see you on Autoline after hours. I miss seeing your face every week. But this is basically going back to last week's show. I called in a little too late regarding the conversation that you were having on the auto buying experience. Recently, I went out to look at a new vehicle, and the dealership I went to, I have to say that the salesman was magnificent, well-versed on every question that I asked, took wonderful care of me. We went out for a test drive, and every dealer has a certain route, and I didn't want to take that route. He told me, hey, drive wherever you want. And I told him up front, I'm not a one-day buyer. I need to think about it. And I told him, you know, if I decided to buy the car, I would be back the next day. The experience went sour when the used car manager held my keys hostage. Every time the salesman went back to get the keys, he said, you know, get a contract signed. Get us, don't let him go. It took me almost a half an hour to get my keys back, and I'll tell you what, that soured me on buying a vehicle at that dealership, and I'm sure other people have experienced it. Hey, that's my comment. Wonderful show. Take care, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks, Dale. That oh, man.
Well, as we've said, you can spend hundreds of millions of dollars on your marketing your image, and it can all come apart in about a half hour at a dealer.
Right.
If they're...
And that kind of treatment. Oh, we'll take your keys, and now I can't even get my... That's BS. That is... yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad. And, you know, like Dale's saying here, love the new car buyer or new car salesperson. The used car guy just ruined the whole deal. Unreal.
And who knows how the F&I guy was.
Right. Well, that's the problem. And that was another big discussion topic at NADA. How do you shrink the time that people have got to spend at a dealership to buy a car? Because if you just walk in cold, it's going to take you 4 hours to walk out with what you want, which is beyond stupid. Now, the only problem is what they're trying to do is get you to do a bunch of stuff online at home or wherever. So you get your finance, you get all that approved, you know what your interest rate is, you have your title, you get your insurance, all that lined up. But all they're doing is taking time that you would have spent at the dealership and shove it on you to do. We're not shrinking the total time it takes to buy a car. We're just offloading it onto the buyer.
So in that scenario, it's sort of analogous to buying airplane tickets, right? We used to use travel agents, and you know, you'd go through that person, and that person would go look at all the flights and the times and the prices and so on and so forth. But now, you know, we go to Delta.com and do it ourselves, and we take care of the whole thing that way. And so at that point, then, what is the value add that the dealer adds to the consumer?
Very little. I mean, the only real value in a future world, in a subscription world, where I can find the car that I want online, see that, it's $600 a month, all in, boom. Deliver it to me. Now, I don't even have to go to the dealer. The only value add of the dealer at that point is when it rolls off the assembly line, it's got to go someplace to a place near you. That's the dealership. When the car breaks down and the shade tree mechanic can't fix it, that's the value of the dealership. You take it to them. Other than that, zip, there's no other value added in the eyes of the consumer.
But, I mean, isn't Hyundai looking at fixed pricing for vehicles, basically.
They're the first ones who experimented.
It's like the Saturn model that it has a price, and that always seemed reasonable to me because when I go to the grocery store, if I want to buy a can of soup, there's a price on it, and I can't take it to the counter and say, no, I'm not going to pay that.
I'll give you 50 cents for it.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And I'm sure that the automakers, you know, they pay X for tires and X for glass and Y for, you know, it has a price. But, you know, if that's the thing, then I just don't understand the real value going forward. I think that this could be a real problem.
Well, a lot of the luxury manufacturers are working to have you never go to the dealer.
Right.
They will come and get the car. They will bring it to you after you...
The aforementioned Lincoln, they were talking about how they would just passed 100,000 pickups and deliveries of vehicles. They'll come and get your car and leave you a Lincoln and bring your Lincoln back when it's ready and washed and gassed and ready. Yeah. You know,
if I'm a luxury manufacturer, I would like the experience with the dealer to be just like that.
Mm-hmm.
So minimally invasive. I don't need to be your friend. I don't, this thing about dealers should develop personal relationships with their, a lot of people.
So this is Jim Farley, who heads up, Ford Global Marketing or
everything.
Marketing and Sales?
Yeah.
He heads up everything. Made a speech at the J.D. Power conference in New York this week, basically saying that he wants the dealer to be more concerned with the existing customer than with trying to get more customers and, getting more value from the person you already have in the hand.
I think it was about to more personal relationships with their customers. I mean, I think people want, they might have a dealer that they go to, but they want minimal hassle to buy and service their car. They don't. Let's face it, it's sad if your friend is at the dealer. I mean, if that's all you got.
Hey, we got some other questions that have come in here. Pedro L. Alexander wants to know, what'd you guys think of the new RAV4 that was unveiled at New York?
I thought it was okay. I mean, I'm sure they'll sell every one they make, but I have trouble warming up to that vehicle. I mean, it's all improved and all that. I'm sure it'll do great for them.
I didn't like the look.
Yeah.
I think it's too trucky.
Well, and that was my observation, is they've made it look more trucky because the market seems to want truck stuff. So, yeah. In fact, there's I think, three different grills, and one of them looks like it came right off the Tacoma.
Right. Yeah. It's just not...
Hey, we do have another phone call from Jonathan. He's a longtime viewer. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hey, guys, it's Jonathan Brown out in Old DeBan, New Jersey. It's so awesome to hear that Peter is going to be the guest on Auto Line After Hours today. It's really fantastic. I'm calling even before the show starts. Here's my question, guys. Cadillac's new twin-turbo hot V8 being built in Bowling Green. They say they're building 3,000 of them there. Do you think Cadillac paid for a portion of the expansion of the Bowling Green facility? That's my first question. Second question, was part of the cost of that hot V engine cast aside in the bankruptcy of 2009-2010? Same with the mid-engine Corvette. Do you think part of the research and development costs were cast aside during the bankruptcy? Will the new Corvette mid-engine, rear mid-engine car be priced within $5,000 of today's car? Will it have a DCT transmission? And will the Cadillac version be differentiated by sheet metal, a 10-speed torque converter automatic, and a hot V engine, whereas the Corvette keeps its overhead valve, forced induction, 6.2 liter? I know you don't know, and if you do know and you can't say, just tell us. We'll have a good chuckle with you. Peter, it's great to have you back on the show. I always miss you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan.
Well, first of all, GM Engineering isn't going to spend the R&D money on that Cadillac V8 for it to be an exclusive to Cadillac. There's just no way. That we're talking, 2,000 CT6Vs? Maybe.
Yeah.
So it may not be the exact, displacement, but you can bet the mid-engine Corvette will have a lot of the engineering in that motor in the Corvette engine. And yeah, the mid-engine car was pushed back because of bankruptcy. And
do you think Cadillac will get a mid-engine version?
I hope not. I really hope.
See, what I wondered, because Johan Dennison was very adamant, this new V8 of ours, it's not going in the Corvette. And I wondered, but he did talk about, hey, we're going to have this amazing Halo car. You know, again, just pure speculation on my part. Shouldn't Corvette, I mean Cadillac, get its own version of this rear mid-engine? And one way you distinguish it is have two completely different engines in the Cadillac versus the Corvette version.
Yeah. I don't know. If I were GM, I would tell Johan, no, you're not going to get a version of that car. Just not.
Yeah. And will the Corvette be within $5,000 of the...
It'll be within 10. Everyone's going to be amazed at what they've done with that car in terms of pricing.
Wow. So you're talking about a $60,000, $65,000 base price.
Yeah.
Because that's where, you know, the current Stingray is about $55,000.
Yeah, it'll be like $65,000, $69,000 for the base car.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of another car, and I need to mention this. Now, we had Chris Reed
Chris Reed from Nissan.
Chris Reed from Nissan.
Yeah.
And when he was on the show, I don't know if you realize this, but we blew up the internet because apparently he let slip the fact that there might have been an all-wheel drive Altima coming. And what did they introduce in New York? An all-wheel drive Altima. Hmm. So for all those viewers who are so adamant about, like, you know, you'd see all these links, you know, on Autoline, he said, you know, it's like, wow, this is really exciting.
Well, there were, you know, a couple of things. I was surprised at the show. The Hot Wheels Camaro convertible.
Yeah.
They look great. I mean, I was kind of, wow, I thought that was just going to be some junky thing, but it looks great. On the other hand, they had an orange ZR1 convertible there with a high black wing on the back, and it did not look good. It looked like a refugee from Fast and Furious, and it looked 10 years old, and it looked bad. They need to rethink that. That was bad. But someone asked me my best in show. My best in show was a 67 Lamborghini Miura in the classic car display. Lime green. Oh, man, that design.
Timeless.
Yeah. Stood the test of time. It's still stunning.
Yeah. Andy G. wrote in to ask us, well, what's the truth about sedans? Asian car makers still churn out new sedans. American brands like Ford want to focus on trucks and more SUVs. I think the Asians are going to start following what's going on in the market. And the market's just going away from passenger.
Yeah, Honda's already slowing down production of their new Accord.
Yeah, they have 105-day supply.
Yeah, and Ford just did a refresh on the Fusion, but, you know, not a super expensive one.
Well, look, the passenger segment is still about 6 million units, 6 million plus. But it's dropped 1.5 million units in 2 years. And this year shows no sign of that drop rate slowing down. Now, we'll bottom out at some point. But, man, if I was a product planner now, I wouldn't be bringing a plan to bring out a new passenger sedan to the board.
So at what point, though, do we have every slice possible of CUV, SUV, such that it becomes untenable?
I think we're close.
2 years.
Yeah, and I think the pendulum will swing back a little. I think people will say, you know, I kind of want to drive a car again. But it's 2 years.
Well, I can tell you for a fact that I can't name names or specific companies, but the industry is concerned about this because all these crossovers from profile pretty much look the same. If you pried off the badges in the grill, 99% of the public could not tell you one from the other. So now what they're all trying to figure out is how do you create a new silhouette, a new look, not just doing it with headlights and grill and trim. How do you come up with a new look that's still a crossover without sacrificing its functionality?
I think we already have that answer with the Jaguar I-Pace.
Could be right.
Which looks fabulous in person.
Sure does. Yeah. I haven't seen it in person. I've only seen video and pictures of it. It's just terrific.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, they're doing a deal with Waymo, and Waymo stuck all their googads on it, and it still looks good. here we got a shot of it up there.
It looks sensational.
No, the proportions on that are just perfect.
They did a great job on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So Waymo is basically placed an order for 20,000 of those vehicles over a two-year period. And So despite the Uber accident, Waymo is not...
Did you hear that Uber reached a settlement already with the family?
Did it really? Woo, yeah. Well, they want to keep it out of court.
I wonder what that
paid
check,
them off.
How
oh,
big
yeah.
that check was. Mm-hmm.
Several million bucks, for sure.
I'm thinking somewhere between 5 and 10.
Could be. You know, if in the GM ignition switch settlement thing, it was about $2.5 million to $3 million per fatality. That's pretty much what you get in court. Now, you can go for punitive damages and blah, 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 but for the actual fatality itself, that's what the courts have determined is the value of a human life, somewhere between $2 and $3 million. But
sad.
It's I'm worth clearly a whole lot more than that. Let's see. We got a
price on the soil and green market.
Right. We're getting towards the end here. We do have another phone call. Yeah, let's bring it in. Somebody took the time to do it.
Part of the problem is on gasoline prices is we passed a massive tax cut. And in addition to that, a massive bill to keep the government in operation. Between the spending and the taxes, somebody has to give. And the value that is given is the dollar. And that is why we are seeing gas prices go up. The dollar is being inflated. And the leading indicator is gasoline prices.
Well, thanks for that observation, whoever you were. No, he does have a good point. As the value of the dollar goes down, price of oil will go up. That's absolutely true.
I'm more concerned about how bad our roads are in the state of Michigan.
Right.
And there's not enough gasoline tax to pay for them.
No, that's absolutely true. So, Gary, what do you think is going to happen at the aftermath of this Uber accident?
Well, I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week, and as we have both apologized if we seemed flippant about the whole thing because we weren't trying to be. But, I mean, it's like, okay, you know, accidents are not things that are planned, okay? And in order to develop this autonomous technology, you know, they can't do it completely on closed courses. They can't completely do it on computers. They have to get it out in the real world. And when you get things out in the real world, things unexpected happen, and
there will be more.
There will be more, and it's an unfortunate thing. But that said, I think that I was looking at a book. You know, we take the auto industry and cars and all that for granted now, but it wasn't always that way. So there's a book that came out MIT Press 10 years ago called "Fighting Traffic: The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City," and this guy points out something very interesting, and I think that we don't realize this. It says, yet before 1920, American pedestrians crossed streets whenever they wished, walked in them, and let their children play in them. The extent of these practices was such that in one of the first organized street safety campaigns in 1914, the Chamber of Commerce in Rome, New York, had to ask pedestrians not to, quote, visit into the street and not to, quote, manicure your nails on streetcar tracks, with limited success. Okay? So it used to be that, you know, that people owned the streets and cars didn't, right? And then, it got to the point that after World War I, again, according to the author, the scale of death and dismemberment on roads and streets in America grew fast. In the first 4 years after Armistice Day, more Americans were killed in automobile accidents than had died in battle in France. Okay? Again, do we think about that? No. But as this new technology came, replacing the horse and buggy and you know, other alternative forms of transportation, people died. But would we give up cars right now? I don't think so.
Never. No, I just think as we get more and more detail of this, and, you know, we have to really wait until the National Transportation Safety Board gives its full report. But it just looks like Uber was cutting corners and not doing things right. And I don't think Waymo, which has done far more testing than Uber has run into any of this. Cruise Automation, which is owned by GM. Aurora, which was a spinoff kind of from Waymo, at least the people. These are all people that know what they're doing. Uber just seemed to be in a rush to try to catch up as fast as possible. Like I said, let's see what the NTSB says. But my guess is they're going to crucify Uber, not the underlying technology.
What do you think, Peter? I know you're a big fan of autonomous vehicles.
Yes.
I think John's on the right track. I mean, I think Uber as a company, there's some things.
This is not their first bad public relations issue.
They got some bad juju running through that company. So, yeah, they're going to get hammered. But the technology development will continue.
Will it be slowed, or will it continue apace, or will it be accelerated?
I think it will continue as is. I don't think it's going to slow down much.
Okay, we got one more call that question that came in here. Then we're going to have to wrap the show up. But Peter, it's directed directly to you. Charles Grenchy wants to know: did Buick do enough with the upcoming Regal GS?
Well, on paper it looks good, but I question who's going to buy the car. I mean, that's not who Buick is catering to. So I don't know if it matters.
I got a picture of it up here too. My question also is, it's an Opel, right? You know, so.
I mean, the enthusiasts who want to search it out will probably like it and want more in it, but it's not going to be one of Buick's, you know, big selling stars. I just don't see how it could be.
Part of the reason, just because it's a passenger car. And
yeah. But their marketing has nothing to do with that at all. Nothing to do. They got that insipid music and, you know, women switching cakes and,
So what do you think about Buick taking the word Buick off of Buicks?
You know, when I think about all the cars that don't have their names, the company names on them, on the one hand, I say, oh, it's bad. But on the other, it's just like, would you miss it? Probably not. But the shield, is that, you know, as powerful as the three-pointed star or the four rings or the BMW propeller? I think that's a reach.
No, I think it's a reach. I think anything that reduces clutter on a car is good.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially domestic cars have often had way too much stuff on the trunk lid, you know. ABS, you know, turbo, yeah. Blah, 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 whatever. You know, why don't they just put the whole bloody option list and get it over with?
Yeah.
But so I think pulling the name off is a good move from that standpoint. But I agree with you, Peter. I'm not so sure. They claim the vast majority of people
know that. They don't know that
shield. They don't know the logo. Exactly. So, but I don't think it's going to hurt them at all.
Yeah.
Like I said, anything to declutter the look of a car is to the good.
Yeah.
But, okay, I remember the first time I saw an Envision, the small-ish crossover vehicle that...
Made in China.
And I was driving along, and I was behind it, and I was coming up, and I was like, wow, what is that car? And this was before it was out. And it just occurred to me that, okay, if it said Buick on it, I would have been, wow... It's like that commercial. Wow, that's a Buick. And you know, by taking that off, I mean, I think that they need as much reinforcement as they possibly can get. So maybe they ought to have Buick on more places on their car. You know what I mean? It's just like, because, you know, until they get established in the consumer's mind as being something, and then, you know, as you were mentioning, I mean, those new Regals are Opals, and presumably that's going to go away because PSA is going to say, why should we, you know, sell them cars? We'll just make them ourselves. You know, what is the design cue that differentiates a Buick from a Chevy or Ford or anything else? So I think that it's probably in haste that they're taking this off, and I think it's going to be, you know, maybe it won't impact them badly, you know, in a big way, but it sure doesn't help.
Yeah. Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap this up, But Peter D.,
glad to have you here, man.
Auto-extreming all over the place.
Yeah. Glad to be here.
And Gary, always good to be with you. We're off next week, I think.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So everybody who's watching, you know right now there will not be a show next week, but thank you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.